Hello and welcome to the Dry Bar Comedy Podcast, the podcast where you get to hang out with some of your favorite Dry Bar comedians, have some laughs, and I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Macon.
And I'm the other host, Taylor Nielsen.
You seemed questioning your last name as you said that, because it is Nielsen, right?
I'm thinking of rebranding.
What would you go with?
Taylor Macon.
That sounds really nice.
That's a nice name.
But don't step on my turf here.
Okay. Well, hey, man. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Good.
Yeah,
it's a good day. It's a good day. Didn't quite time the Red Bull right today.
Yeah, you're on the downward swing right now.
A little too early with it.
I think the adrenaline will kick in once you see who our guest is.
Once we get the guest out here, it's going to really kick me in here.
It's going to be huge.
Let's do it.
So let's throw it a clip.
Let's jump to it.
My father gave me one really wise piece of advice before I got married, and it's held true for 32 years. On my wedding day, my father said to me, before you argue with your new wife, and you're going to argue with her, before you do, take some time, step back, ask yourself two questions. Do you want to be right, or do you want to be happy? Right. And then he broke down and sobbed right in front of me. I had no idea what that man was talking about. 32 years later, I can tell you this, I'm a happy, happy, happy man. I ain't been right in 12 years now.
All right, guys, so you know who that was. You love his Dry Bar specials. He's got three. He's recording a fourth, including Honor Thy Wife, and I can laugh about it now. Give it up for the wonderfully funny Jeff Allen.
Hey. You didn't tell me I had to be funny. I wouldn't have had those pancakes. We went to IHOP today for a meeting, and we realized that it had been well over a decade since we've eaten. And after eating there, I go, it'll be another decade at least.
Yeah. What'd you go with? What'd you get at IHOP?
I get the blueberry pancakes without the compote. You know, I don't like that blueberry goo. Now, one of my agents was with me, and he got the Girl Scout cookie pancakes. I said... If I ate that, I would be like Thorazine. I just, bam, my head would hit the table. Yeah. I barely made it back to the hotel after eating all those goo.
Did it have all the different Girl Scout cookies in it?
Just the mints.
You've got Jordan's attention.
And he was upset because the green on the bottom of the pancake was just food dye. It wasn't mint.
It wasn't minty.
Oh, it was like minty. A thin mint.
Well, yeah. IHOP's about the aesthetics, we know.
Well, and the pictures look
Yeah.
I always say that about Jack in the Box. This was Jack in the Box. You look at the taco in the picture, man. You're going, oh my God, I got to get those. And you get them, and it's like you're holding up the taco, looking at it next to the. Wait a minute.
What is this?
What you get is two pieces of crepe paper with a wet spot in the middle.
Yeah.
You
know?
Menu catfishing. Yeah. That's what that is.
Weirdly enough, that's like my wife's favorite fast food item. And they just barely started putting Jack in the Boxes here in Utah. And we went to one last weekend. And she got those tacos, and she was so happy.
Oh, I ate them all after, you know, a night of, deep thinking and mission work in the bars. I was doing mission work in the bars.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Those breakfast places are the worst way to start a day sometimes. They will knock you out.
I went to school late in high school, 11 o'clock, because we had such a big high school. There were split shifts. And my mother would leave a bucket of waffle batter and next to the waffle iron, and I had waffles every day before I went to school. I was asleep on the bus. I would just start nodding off, you know, and I can't eat that stuff in the morning. I don't. Yeah. My body just doesn't process it well.
It really is the best way to do IHOP is go late at night and then go straight to bed.
That's it.
For 12 hours.
Sleep it off. Gotta sleep it off.
You know, but now at my age, my stomach would just reject. You guys are too young, but there was an Alka-Seltzer commercial years ago. I still remember. It was great. It was a stomach in a chair and the guy arguing with his stomach. I like pepperoni pizza. Yeah, you like heartburn? I'm going to get heartburn every time you eat a pepperoni pizza. And that's the way I think about it. Every time I eat something that I know before I even eat it. My stomach's going to go, you like it? A heartburn? Come on. You're gonna get it. So I have the executive bottle of Tums in my bag. I just chew them.
I'm there already to the point where I'm getting heartburn all the time.
Yeah.
That and Prilosec are my saving my life sometimes. Yeah.
They should give those Tums out like dinner mints after
I have. Well, I like how, in fact, I've sucked you into my world. This is what old people talk about all the time. I used to tell the young people, they'd come to my club shows, I'd see some young people in the front and go, well, after an hour and a half with me, you think you just had Thanksgiving dinner with your grandparents. My God, how many ailments does this guy have?
Yeah.
Hey, you only know what you know.
That's right. Well, yeah, you've got plenty of material. I mean, you've got done three Dry Bar specials, and you're recording a fourth one this weekend.
Yeah, this one will be interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was working it for the last 6 weeks on the road, I would tell the audience up front, I'd go, the first 25, 30 minutes, I'm working on a new Dry Bar. I got notes. I said I used to try to hide the fact that I had notes, but I don't care anymore. I'd walk over and look at it, and I go, now you're going to see this in August and say, wow, that was so much better in August. It's an interesting process. Of putting things together. And it isn't so much the material, I have that. It's the structuring and segue. I've spent as much time on segues as I do the actual material, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, your act is always very cohesive, and it just feels like a natural progression of the stories and
because
jokes.
I want to eliminate as much of editing as possible. And as long as everything kind of flows together, it makes it easier. I had an issue with another company I did a tape with, and we fought on the contract. I wanted 15 minutes of continuous comedy. I don't care where, but once you start, I want 15 minutes running. And they took a piece of mine, which I'm going to do tonight, and they chopped it to shreds. And I was so angry. And he goes, well, it wasn't getting many laughs. I go, it's Hollywood, sweet. Since when does that even matter? I did a special that I was the fourth act up in a room that was 108 degrees at 2.5 hours in. I didn't get a laugh the whole 45 minutes. And I knew that all I had to do was look like I was getting laughs. So I'm up there smiling, pacing myself, pausing where there should be laughs. And I walked off and I looked at the director and I said, you better make that look good. He goes, oh yeah, I know right what I'm going to do. So
how'd it turn out?
Well, it got great. You know, you listen to it, you know. And I learned that from Star Search. I went to see a friend of mine in the finals. John Campanaro was in the finals with Jenny. What's her name? Anyway, she didn't get a laugh. Not one laugh. And he killed. And she won, he lost. And that's when I realized, I go, it doesn't matter. I said, those are all Johnny's laughs. She's got Johnny's laughs.
You know? You can't do it on shows that aren't recorded, though, because then I've tried that before.
No, live shows, you can't. You can't hide live.
Just pause for the right amount of time you think the joke deserves.
Did you ever see the movie My Favorite Year?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's about an aging actor who's brought to America to basically go on Sid Caesar's show of shows in the 60s. It was a live show. Uh-huh. And he goes, live television. He starts freaking out. He goes, you're an actor. He goes, I'm not an actor. I'm a movie star. And the thought of doing live anything was like, no, I don't get 12 takes. I don't get to.
Yeah. That makes me curious. Have you ever done any acting work?
Is I got a movie coming out, I think, in March. It's an independent thing, a faith film. We did a year ago, September.
Oh, cool.
So it was supposed to be out in December, and they were having some budget issues. It'll probably, you know, go to YouTube or whatever. But they called me, and they got a hold of me on Facebook, said, have you ever acted? I said, I took a bunch of classes. When I turned 60 in Nashville, I told my wife I'm going down to take some acting classes. She goes, why? You're starting a new career? I go, no, we live in the country. We live rural Tennessee. And I said, this is where artists go to die. I said, I when I'm home, I don't feel like I'm part of the business, you know, which is, and one level it's great because I can relax and do other things. But after a week or two at home, you're going, oh God, I got to do something. So I just started taking scene study and really had a blast. All these kids, being around young, creative people, they're not quite as bitter as I am.
They'll get there. They'll get there.
They still have the belief that, you know, everything in this business runs fairly and, you know, they'll be fine. But I did some music videos with them and was blown away at what you can do with an iPhone.
That's cool.
I mean, some kid was he was a musician. He did a music video. He asked me to play his dad or something. I don't know. And we shot it in his living room. And I thought, gee, what's this going to look? When he showed it to me, it was as good as anything I've ever seen on MTV. So you think about it, you know, you're getting involved with these studios, and they go, well, we need a $500,000 budget to shoot a video. No, you don't. I saw a kid do it on nothing. I didn't even take a nickel. I mean, there's all these acting students that'll be more than happy to you know. I did a Cody Johnson video. I think I made $25. And every now and then someone will send me a message. Was that you in the Cody Johnson video? I go, it was. So anyway, they asked if I've acted. This is my first really big role. I've had bit parts. And it was an interesting process. This is my description of what acting is like. All right, Jeff, you're going to walk in the room and say, hey. And I said, okay. So I walk in, I go, hey. And they go, all right, now look over there and say, hey. Hey. Now look over there and say, hey. Hey. Look up there and, hey. Now we're going to turn the camera around the back. They're going to get you from the back saying, hey. Hey. Anyway, after 22 hays, you just sit down for another 3 hours and wait for the next.
Wow.
Man. The next one. I told my wife I'd go insane. I mean, and it's interesting because talking to the students who were in class that had gotten on projects, they loved the process. They loved being, you know, the whole thing.
And I'm right.
Holy cow, stand-up comedy is so much better, man. You deliver a line, you know right away if they liked it or not.
Right.
I'll wait till a month when it comes out. We'll see if they like it or not.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to what kind of job I did. The actress that was my co-star, she's been in a ton of films, and we really hit it off. It was really fun. She really helped me out with a lot of stuff. And just hitting your marks and things. So now if somebody asks, can you act? I go, I can hit my mark and I can remember the lines.
You know?
What's
your role in the movie? What's your character?
Well, they stretched me. They really did. I play a grandfather.
You must have transformed.
My wife, it was Minnesota. My wife dies in January. In Minnesota, you can't bury people in January because the ground's frozen. So May or June, whatever, whenever the funeral was, my daughter comes in with my granddaughter from California. And I'm just loopy enough to where the two sisters get together and go, somebody has to stay here and be with Dad. And my granddaughter wants to go back to California. And she's an avid reader, so she just looks up this small town library. And there's seven old women there putting books away. And she befriends the seven women and realizes, if I can hook my grandfather up with one of these women,
okay,
then I don't have to stay here. I can go back to California. So it's called My Seven Grandmas. So,
that's fun.
I like that premise. That sounds fun.
Yeah, and it's a nice thing. I mean, it's again, when you see it shot, you wonder how they'll ever put this thing together because it's never shot in order.
Totally. It's
different scenes, you know. So, and he has a vision in his head. He'll say something like, "Well, we can clean that and post because in the scene and you know tomorrow we'll be shooting over here," and they're kind of, I mean, how they do it is beyond me. I mean,
the directors keep a lot together, they've
got it all planned out before you step foot on set, you know. And a lot of it location stuff and one camera.
Oh really?
Yeah, oh yeah,
think about that. You have three here.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Two. I don't know.
And people are asking us for less coverage of ourselves.
And they honestly probably just want this one right here.
They're like, we don't need these others going on.
Did
you learn anything? Oh, sorry to cut you off, Taylor.
No, go ahead. But
my question is going to be really good.
I'm happy.
Did your acting classes and learn anything where you influenced your comedy, or did you feel like comedy helped with acting?
Yeah, it did. It made me a little more braver in trying to act out a piece where I would bail on it because I knew I was acting, so I assumed they knew I was acting.
Oh, right. That's interesting.
So now I'm there's some subtler, nuanced things that the audience would never know. But for me, it's like, well, I would have never taken that chance 10 years ago.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Very cool.
And I think it just fills the stuff better. That's all.
Pretty good question I asked, right?
Yeah, I like that question. Thank you, Jordan.
Just sorry, I cut you off.
It was along the similar lines. I was going to ask you. So you like the immediacy of getting that response from stand-up?
Gosh, it's all I ever wanted to be, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so interesting to me. I started with people that all they wanted to do was get famous. And it never entered my mind. I just thought if I got good at what I did, I would enjoy what I do. And that's really what I wanted to do with my life, was enjoy my life. And then the process of stand-up, you know, I've because of Dry Bar and how much exposure this stuff is getting, the people are starting to comment, oh, I've seen all this stuff, you know, and comedy is not music. You know, they'll hear the same song 50 times.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
They don't want to hear the same joke. So it's like, I'm for the first time in my entire career, I'm worried about content. I mean, how much material I got. So I reached out to a couple of writers in LA and they sent me some stuff. And the bottom line is everything I do is personalized. So even if they gave me something, I look at it more as a premise that I didn't think of. I mean, and I'm asking these guys who are married. I go, look, you've had arguments with your wife. Give me one, you know, and nothing. I go, you don't argue. If I was home 7 days without an argument, man, I'd be like one eye open sleeping. Something's wrong here.
She's too quiet.
She's either stepping out on me or she's going to kill me. I just love the process of stand-up. I really do. It's all when I laid eyes on it, it was a comedy team. I was always a huge Cosby fan. You know, whenever the comics came on the Tonight Show and stuff, I'd sneak out of my room and my parents would have it on and I'd listen to it on the stairs or something. But when I saw him, I just thought, how neat. You know, I was 17 years old maybe when I first saw stand-up. And back then, you know, it's, you know, where do you do it? How do you learn it? I mean,
right.
You know.
And where were you at that time? Where'd you grow
up? I live in Chicago. I grew up in a small town in Illinois outside of Chicago. But anyway, I was working for a jewelry company 5 or 6 years later, and they said something about a comedy club, and I went, what's that? And then that was it. I mean, August of 78, and then Thanksgiving night, I finally drank enough. It was very funny. Thursday night and Sunday night were open mic nights. So I go up Thursday night, and I'm just horrifically bombed.
It was on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, and I was hanging out for 3 months. Every comic knew I wanted to do it. I just didn't have the courage to go up. Uh-huh. So the night I go and do it, they all come out of the back room. And I was doing magic. I did close-up magic. So I tried to do some magic tricks,
Really? Work. Really?
Yeah, and just awful. So I go back. I go home humiliating. When I get humiliated, I punch things. So I punched holes in my closet door. I was so humiliated.
Oh, no.
So I'm back Sunday night signing up for open mic night, right?
And what made you want to go back?
Well, my wife asked me the same question. I wanted to do it. I don't know if I was a sadist or a masochist, but somebody was getting punished and enjoying it. Me or the audience. I don't know. But anyway, the MC came over. It was a very large black man. He came over to me and said, you're going to have to make some sense tonight. All of us are trying to figure out what you said Thursday night. And anyway, I had terrible stage fright for almost a year. I mean, there were nights I'd walk up, look at the crowd, draw a blank, and leave.
Oh, no.
And to this day, when why I've had a hard time getting any traction in L.A. and New York was because of the audition process. I do terrible with memorizing 3 to 4 minute sets. I do better, like when I go out on the road, I do 1 hour and 15 to 1 hour and a half. That's a breeze for me because I don't have any pressure to remember anything. I just kind of go with what, and you do it enough. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not really scripted, but you know, to memorize something, I'll get to a line and I go, oh, God, I know what's next. And then that hiccup, that little split second it takes throws your rhythm off.
Yep.
And now you think they saw it. They know it. Mm-hmm. And then the panic starts. When I auditioned for America's Got Talent, I drew a blank twice.
No.
I'm up there. I walk out. I go, blah, blah. And this is stuff I wrote. I mean, it's not like they gave me a script 20 minutes before taping. So I go out. I go, nah, 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 nah. The third line is gone. Just gone. So I stop. Wow. I mean, I know enough.
Was this in front of the judges or was it a pre-audition process?
No, this was with judges. Oh,
who was judging at the time? Was Simon?
Sophia Vergas, Heidi Klum, and Howie. So anyway, you know, and again, Simon was gracious. I just stopped. I said, well, we're taping. Can I do this again? He goes, oh, sure. And he said, please don't take your time. Again, we're taping. There's no pressure. I go, okay. Line one, line two, gone.
The ones now, you just did?
I'm panicking. Now I'm panicking because I cannot remember that stupid third line. So Simon says, hey, would water help you out? I go, water would be anything to buy me time. So Terry Crews is walking across the stage and he's encouraging me. Come on. Yeah. I'm trying. I can't remember this stupid line. And I'm taking a sip of water and it came to me, man. And I did the 90 seconds and they all said, that's great. You know, the four yeses and And then they passed on the, you know, I told my wife when I got home, I said, I'm not being negative, but they're not going to take that. I mean, it's one thing to draw blanks, you know, on taping. I said, they're going to live shows. I said, they don't want some old man. You know, if you're 25 years old and you draw a blank, America's going to root for you. You're 65 years old, you draw a blank, you're going, why is he out of the home? Yeah, you know, what's this old man doing? Like, get him out of here! Oh, you so old funny. Geezer, go! You know, so, no, they're not going to risk that on live TV.
Oh, man.
Sure enough, they passed.
When I see you on stage in these Drabber specials, I can't think of anyone more confident, right? I mean,
again, it's 25, 30 minutes. I'm fine.
Yeah.
You know, if Drybar came to me right now and said, put together a 3-minute set, I mean, I need notes.
Interesting.
You know, yeah.
Do you have any kind of problem like that with memorization? Or?
I've definitely had times where being recorded around things that were stressful things. Like even the last Dry Bar one I recorded, these jokes I've been doing for a long time, I felt really confident going in. And then on each show, there was like two lines I forgot. And I'm like, why did I forget it now? Well, out of all the times.
Yeah, it was interesting because doing the best of last night, I got a chance to correct all that.
Oh, yeah.
That's good. There were lines when I watched the drive-by special, I go, oh, my gosh. And one of them was really cool was on the low T, testosterone. You know, I found out I was elevated in estrogen, and I added a line that I was so great to do last night. The original line in the first round, all I had was, it explained all the HGTV I was watching. You know, Bears are on Sunday. No way, Chip and Joanna got a special. I'm not missing that. But I added a line in that. I go, you know, you're elevated in estrogen. Well, it certainly explains why I cannot find a bathing suit I look good in. Isn't that a great line?
That's funny. Yeah.
That's so cool that you're able to take these jokes that you obviously have history with, you like them, but then you're able to take kind of a step back, added experience, and then add some more jokes.
Oh, I'm always, I've said for 25 years, if I'm as good as I'm going to get, I should quit.
Right.
You know? And I had a pastor take me to the side. I got to Nashville when I was 40. I became a believer when I was 40 years old. So I go to Nashville, where our marriage is just getting together. And my pastor called, I don't even know the guy knew I was at his church. I mean, we were at a church once for 15 years, and I told Tammy, as people were streaming out, I go, point somebody we know. 15 years, we didn't know anybody. I mean, we're not antisocial. We're just not the kind that just walk up to people we don't know and go, hi, we're Jeff and Tammy. You know, and then they go, you gum on our shoe, get out of here. So anyway, he calls me in, and he said, I understand you want to work churches in the Christian marketplace. And I said, well, I'm thinking about it. Right now I'm doing clubs for 7 days a week, and it was, it was getting to be a grind, you know. And I was in Vegas when 9/11 happened, and I couldn't get out, and that was really what solidified the leap. I said, went to my Jewish manager. You think churches will hire me? He goes, what do I know? You know? So anyway, it was an interesting transition. The first year I put my resume out. And it's almost like you're saying to a woman, you know, I'm willing to date you. And she goes, I'm not even going anywhere near you.
You know, good to know.
So
good
I
know.
Basically was saying with my resume to the churches, hey, I'm willing to come in and do what I do for you. And I go, I did one church in an entire year.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And your resume's casinos, nightclubs and stuff. They hesitate to give you the pulpit for an hour, you know, especially comedian. So anyway, I forgot what we were talking about. This is the old thing.
We're along for the ride, wherever it goes. Did you have to adjust your act a lot from, or were you already doing?
No, I started cleaning up before that. My son got caught cussing at his teacher in fourth grade. So, you know, we're pretty pragmatic people. I walked in, I said to the teacher, I'd love to look you in the eye and seriously say, I have no idea where that child heard that kind of language. Right. So anyway, we were going home, and Tammy said, you know, that reflects on us more than it does him. And so I made a point to clean up. I told the kids, I'll give you a quarter, you know, because I was probably unaware of 90% of it that came out of my mouth. So anyway, I gave them a quarter for every foul word, which is basically how I funded their college. So that was, you know. But it was an interesting process at home, and I thought, I wonder if I could do it on stage. And as a storyteller, it made me so much better at what I do, because I had to get a thesaurus out. I had to figure out a way to work around the lazy parts, which was the language. And it was a lot more fun. It really was.
But you grew to like doing churches, right? Because you ended up doing a lot of churches.
Well, it was a great fit for me because as a storyteller, I realized pretty quick that they're used to sitting quietly and listening to someone use metaphors and paint pictures. I mean, good pastors, you know, they're good speakers. And it was a great fit. It really was. And then there comes a point. I used to be so quick in the clubs because I didn't even ask rhetorical questions because I didn't want some drunk to interrupt me. I mean, I didn't do well when I handled hecklers. I almost got beat up a few times, and it was just like, this isn't worth it.
Well, it's so hard to find the line between.
Well, I learned from Cosby. I was in Atlantic City, finally got a chance to see him live, and he had some guy down in the front. He was talking to Earl, and at one point, Earl just kept jabbering on, and Bill Cosby goes, Earl, yes, Mr. Cosby, I'm going to work alone now. And I thought, what a great way to handle this.
Yeah.
So I started doing that in the clubs. If somebody was starting to talk, I'd go, hey, man, wait, well, let's get to know each other. What's your name? And Mike, wow, you live here? Do about a minute.
Uh-huh.
And go, Mike, I'm going to work alone now. This whole thing you and I are doing. Not a lot of laughs. And it was great because it diffused. They got the attention they want.
Yeah.
Not in the way they wanted it.
Right.
But that was also, I mean, I can't take you on the road with me, Mike. As much as I love you. I mean, as much as we've bonded in the last 60 seconds, you and I, this isn't going to work out. We can be friends.
That's good. I like that.
I do. I did. And because, I was vicious. I had a guy waiting in the park, pacing like a caged cat. And his girlfriend was sitting on the hood of the car, And I told the club owner, I'm not going out there. I'm not anywhere near as motivated as this man is around the park.
He's invested.
So anyway, after 45 minutes, he left, and I thought he might be back. My favorite story, I had a guy destroyed the middle act. And I walk out on stage, and the first thing he says to me, loud enough for the entire room to hear, I got to look at your ugly mug. And I said, no, actually, I said, we are all given choices in life. You can sit there with your mouth shut, or you can get up and leave, or we'll make you leave. And then I realized, you know what? I got a choice here. I can work with you in the room, or I can work with you out of the room. I want you out. And it took me a few minutes to get the management over there to get him out. And as he stood up, I realized he's like 6'7". And he just kept rising up. And at one point, he bends down to fix his boot. And I was this close to diving and going, gun!
Yeah,
right.
And he stood up and he did one of these. And I thought for sure he was going to catch me somewhere, parking lot. But that's when I realized, if I ignore him and I try... But the churches, shockingly, not a lot of hecklers.
I was going to ask, yeah.
But it was a good fit. And I was really, I think, if I wasn't the first, I was certainly in the top five to bring stand-up into the church.
Oh, really?
Right? Yeah, most of them were what they call humorists. They had a nice message for the – and I'll tell you how I got – it was very funny. I was doing my first really big event was for Bill Gaither, the singer, and he had 15,000 people at this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I go up the first night and I do 10 minutes. And never worked for that many people. And you get goosebumps. I mean, the first line I deliver, you get this wave of, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
I could dig this.
Uh-huh.
When you come from a club of 40 people and then you're in front of 15,000.
Right.
So anyway, the next day I'm doing a breakout. They had all these different breakout rooms and there's 300 or 400 people in the breakout sessions. One of his people grabbed me and said, hey, we loved what you did last night. And anybody who's been around the Christian world, the butt's coming, we love what you do, but
Yeah.
So he says, could you mention you love your wife? I said, they don't know that. He goes, well, you hit her kind of hard. And I'm thinking, oh, you have no idea. I mean, what I used to do back in the, you know, in the club, she'd leave in tears. You know, no. I mean, I was brutal. I mean, I wrote about it in the book. But anyway, so I do my 15 minutes of breakout. And, you know, they're clapping and everything. And I'm walking off. And I realize, I forgot to tell them I love my wife. So I walk back. And they settle down. And I start talking about Tammy. Well, I start crying. I mean, crying. I've never experienced wow. anything like this in public in my life. Anyway, I walk off and Tammy goes, what the hell was that? I mean, I said, I don't know. But that's what I started offering the church as a, I realized they're paying me out of tithes and offerings. So I needed to do something in the form of what ministry looked like. And the only right. thing I had was I was a drunk and an alcoholic. Christ captured my heart and this is our life today,
you yeah. know?
And far from perfect, but boy, the peace that came with that decision was the gift. I mean, everything else is a byproduct of the fact that I'm no longer in turmoil inside, you know, about meaning and point and purpose to life. So anyway, every time I'd work at church, Tammy goes, you do testimony? I go, yeah, they asked for it. She goes, did you go Jimmy Swagger? Did you swagger them? You know, did you start crying? Shut up, man. You know? But it was an interesting process to me. It really was. Because some nights, yes, some nights, no, and all different points. But the realization of what you've been brought from to where you're at, and I believe it, you know, as a wholeheartedly, that it was just a gift of grace. And the revelation of who he is, you know. And so anyway, I wrote about it in the book. Are We There Yet?
Yeah, tell right. us more and about your book, because you told us before, we're talking before, but I don't think we talked about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Tammy had pushed me for about 10 years. I used to tell Tammy, I'm not a writer. I'm a storyteller, you know, but I don't write. And she goes, what do you mean? I go, writers write. I don't know a writer who didn't start writing at 12 years old, and they write like every day. They write every week. They yeah. write short stories. They write big things. Whatever. They write. They love to write. I abhor the process of writing. I like to have an idea, a concept. I write three words, and then I try to flush it out verbally. Well, you can't do that in a book. You have to actually get it on paper. So over the years, I put together a bunch of things because of the pressure she put me under. I'd come back from the golf course, you know, shot 69 today. What'd you write on the book? Okay, let's have an argument. I said, not a word, baby. I didn't write a word today, you know. So anyway, I was doing something for NRB, the National Religious Broadcasters in Nashville, a convention. And somebody from Salem Broadcasting was backstage and said, really like you, you know. You're a funny guy. How come I've never heard of you? I go, well, it's been the issue my whole career. You know? So anyway, they went back and they saw something online about the testimony. I posted it years ago. And anyway, they called and asked if I have any of that written down. And the cardinal rule of entertainment is, you know, if they come to you and go, can you ride a horse? You go, absolutely. I've been yep. doing it since I was a kid. And then tomorrow you take horse riding lessons. You know, so I said, yeah, I got some stuff written down. And the beauty of this whole thing is I sent them what I've written, and they wrote back 2 days later, obviously you're going to need some help. Thank you. I showed Tammy, see, these are professionals. I'm not a writer. So we found a guy in Atlanta, and I said to him, we'll have a nice relationship if you can just let me tell the stories. You just tell me what stories need to be told, and you help me with the editing. But I want to, in my voice, and one of the biggest compliments I get from people who've read it go, I hear you page yeah. to page to page to page. So that was meaningful to me. But I got sober at 31, and I got saved at 38, and the book is those years in between. We had just a horrific marriage, but mm-hmm. for some reason, we stayed together, and I wrote it for millennials because now they're married, they have kids, and I think, you know, if you're 40 years old and you bought the American lie that if you have the right stuff you'll be happy, you know, and you're looking around, you know, because that's what I would go through. I would look. I didn't have a lot, but I had a beautiful wife, kids who love, you know, I mean, healthy kids. So you check the boxes, you know, And my friends would go, what are you so miserable about? I go, I honestly don't know. I used to tell Tammy, you know, it'd be a lot easier if I was in prison and people were beating me every day. And then people go, why are you miserable? Well, I'm in prison and people are beating me every day. But I'd look around and you know, and then she'd shake me some days. You know, we're losing the house. You don't care. I go, I don't. She'd go, why? And I go, I don't know. I honestly, I feel the weight of it. Believe me.
Yeah.
I just don't know why. I used to tell married people, if you're in marriages that are acrimonious, wait to get to apathy. I mean, and I see that apathy in the airports. It's toxic to me. I'll see these young men just sitting there. You can see the boredom in their face just looking at the screens. And you go,
let's do a cut to Taylor's face right now. Oh, there it is. That's good.
There it is. That's it. I got it. I just felt the chills. You know, I lived my life like that. I was a full-blown nihilist. Imagine being married to that. You know?
I mean, yeah, and especially with – I mean, social media, I feel like, can really intensify that feeling.
Well, it is, because you think everybody out there is living the life they're portraying. I do a line in my act. I said, you know, in 85, when I met my wife, if they had dating apps, and if I was honest, my profile would have read alcoholic, drug addict with rage issues, looking for single female to overlook aforementioned character flaws. I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, I used to tell my son would get wrapped up in that. I go, I said, look at your profile. You lied through your teeth.
Right.
Do you think they're not lying?
Yeah.
If you're looking outside, you know, and that's the thing that, you know, I write about it in the book, that we tend to look externally to validate internally. And politics was a wonderful thing for me in the 90s. I mean, I was miserable. So I'd watch the news and people go, why are you miserable? And because of them, you know, look at these politicians. They're, and it's an easy one. Because everybody has a thing about the system somewhere if you connect with the, you know, the right people. But it's a lot more polarized today.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I was miserable and I didn't know why. And anyway, for me, you know, and I always tell the audiences in all sincerity, if you can get through the first six chapters of my book without killing yourself, it's an uplifting tale. A friend of mine wrote the foreword. He never met us back then. He didn't know us. He knew us as we are today. Uh-huh. And he read the first five chapters. He calls me. He goes, my gosh, who are these people? Wow. He goes, are you telling the truth? I go, why would I lie about that stuff?
Yeah. You know?
But just adding some flavor.
To me, it wasn't enough to say I was an angry husband, an angry man. It was I had to give an example of what that looked like in practice.
Yeah.
And it's not pretty. Tammy read the first two chapters, put it down, you know, of the final draft and said, I can't read anymore. We were horrible people.
Yeah.
And I said, that's the beauty of the arc, you know, if you finish the end. And when Andy wrote the foreword, he said, you're going to meet two couples. Don't give up on the second couple. You know, don't read about the first couple and give up on them.
Yeah.
You know, and for whatever reason, you know, we came out the other end of all of that. And we look back and we call ourselves those people.
Right. How has stand-up been an outlet to you?
Oh, gosh, always, yeah.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I always worked inside out. So when we were going through all our marital trouble, those occasions that Tammy would come out, I was vicious. I mean, and there's a point where I worked with a guy one night, and he was telling me, he worked with, I think it was Jake Johansson. Comic, funny guy, San Francisco. And Jake didn't do well, had a pretty rough set. And the guy I was working with killed. So they're driving back to the condo. And Jake is sitting there quietly. And at some point he goes, yeah, that was a good show. And the MC goes, thank you. He goes, I wasn't talking about your show. I was talking about my show. And he goes, yeah, but you bombed. And he goes, nah, not really. If I'm thinking about the people that were laughing, I would have handpicked them to put them in my crowd. And that stuck with me. And I started looking around at the people I was connected with.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of wife beater shirts, you know. Yeah, a lot of tats, a lot of, you know, drunks.
Right.
Yeah, men that I would not want to go out and have a drink with or hang with or whatever. So in self-assessing, I was connecting with the wrong folk.
Yeah,
and, interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I had a hard time. I had women club owners that called my agent and go, I don't want him back.
Wow.
I just don't like the way he talks about his wife. And, yeah, it was brutal.
I'm thinking about people I connect with, and man, they're such losers.
Yeah, the homeless.
All just Jordan making clones in the audience.
Oh, I need to reevaluate.
Well, I'll tell you, I guarantee you,
I know.
Next time you hit the stage, you'll start, especially if you're not doing well, you'll look around and go, who's laughing?
Oh, that's you?
Interesting. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So it's got to change.
That's funny. I never thought about that barometer before, but that is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big arc just from club owners saying no more because you're too mean about your wife to crying about how much you love your wife in the church.
Well, it is, too. But so that's the transforming power of the gospel to me. I mean, it changes because people ask, what's different? My heart changed. I don't, you know, again, I don't know how it works. I mean, you know, the greatest testimony in the Bible is I was blind and now I see, you know.
Right.
You know, Jesus cured his blindness and he said, how did he do it? I don't know, you know. All I know is, but did he hocus pocus? Did he, you know, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. And that's, again, I wish I could have given it to my brother, you know. You know, he went to his grave, you know, just hanging on. And
that's hard.
It was sad to watch. It really was. You know, he'd call me from the alleys in front of the crack houses before, you know, he'd lose his cell phone. You know, he'd get clean and then get his life together and then he'd go back to crack and... Where's your Jesus now? Where's your Jesus now? I go, he's right there. It's right there, man. You know, I mean, it sounds, you know, I know what it sounds like because I used to mock it, you know. Mm-hmm. I did for years. I had people hand me tracks after shows, you know, like, you know, throw it in their face and stuff, you know. So I don't know. But the five questions I ask in the book that I ask, I go through about once a month. I have to assess what defines me. Most men will give a vocation. And if your vocation describes you, you're at the mercy of your vocation for your peace and connection to meaning. Mm-hmm. So if long as I look higher, you know, I think Sartre said before he passed, and he was an atheist, I think he was the father of existentialism, and he said that he realized in order for something finite to have meaning, it has to be fixed and attached to something infinite and fixed. So I, God. And then what do I value? You know, if it was stuff, which, you know, there's never enough. Pascal said there's a hole in all of us. We keep trying to push that in. And so I try to value integrity where I integrate what I believe with how I live. I'm not there. I mean, you know, when people call me a hypocrite, I go, yeah, okay.
I accept.
Hello.
I accept.
Hello. You know, and then what are your expectations? That's a huge one. I always tell Tammy, if you just lower your expectations, I'd meet every one of them and you'd be a lot happier. And then what voices do you listen to? Noisy culture, garbage in, garbage out. I've told my kids 1,000 times, you live in the greatest time in the history of the world. You can bring the greatest minds into your living room and or play Animal Farm, you know. I don't know. But, you know, whatever you want to do. I mean, but you can. Garbage in, garbage out. Whatever edifies, will edify on the way out. And then the last one is, where does your hope lie? And if it's in the next election, I pity you. I really do. Because I've been around long enough and paid enough attention to go, they just don't care about you at all, except during election season. Yeah.
I feel like nobody's excited about the next election. Like, just
I'm waiting for the next. About nobody. I'm waiting for the next.
Yeah, that's true.
The next pandemic, but they got it worked out for the election when they got us locked down. You'll be able to give your ballot to DoorDash, so
they always do
and they'll put it in a lockbox. You know?
Yeah, man. Wow. Well, I think that in your stand up to this, like these deeper life lessons come through. And that's something I really enjoy about watching you work because it's hilarious and I learn something too when I'm watching you. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks. For me, the stuff that makes me laugh begins with a kernel of truth, you know?
Yeah.
Because people ask, is it true? I go, well, you know, kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
You know,
it began there.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting. I'm telling a story tonight in the new dry bar that my manager gave me about his kid, you know? So I'll take anything. I don't care, you know? And then I made up a third kid for years because it was a great joke. And had two specials come out on DVD where I had three kids. And then the last one, was two kids. People were emailing me.
What happened? People have been following along.
Did the baby die?
We're so sorry for your loss.
Should we pray for you? I mean, it was like, so anyway, my manager calls me one day and he goes, you got to say something publicly. Go on Facebook and say something. So anyway, I go out and go, look, I made the kid up. It's not a documentary. People were angry. Angry. You lied? I go, yeah. You know, I mean.
They hung a lot of hope on that brownie
child. That was my
child.
Opening of the Man. Testimony. I said, the comedy gives me permission to lie like with impunity. I said, this, I have to tell the truth.
Good, good thing you told the truth, because you'd still be pretending there was a kid to this day.
Yeah, now he'd be 20.
A child. You know, to get an actor.
I started it back 20-some years ago, so where's where's your third kid? Oh, he doesn't like us.
Were you claiming that kid on your taxes, too?
No, that's funny. No, I didn't even think of that. Now that you can be as delusional as you want.
Might as well.
Throw it on there. Your bio mentions about you being a grandpa now. It's only positive in your bio. Is that the best job, being a grandpa?
What's the coolest thing about it is I missed with my kids because I was on the road all the time. Things like the first words, you know, told a story last night, the first time your granddaughter says your name, Papa, you know. Yeah, it's funny, Tammy made me, she said, and it's funny, I asked the audience, last night was one of the few times I asked, and they go, because I ask, oh, Grandpa, who picked your name, them or you? 99% of the time they say, we let the kid pick, and I go, are you kidding me? You let an 18-month-old pick your name for life? The kid could go, ha, 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 and then that's your name. 30 years later, this is my ha, ha, ha. You know, and you're going, no, they're 18 months. You don't let them make any decisions.
Yeah, let's rework this later on. We'll
so anyway, Tammy sits me down about a month before the baby's born and says, we need to pick because we're not going to let them pick. So she says, I'm Mimi. I don't want to be Nana, Grandma, any of those. So Mimi. Mm-hmm. And she says, have you thought about it? I go, no. So he said, give me a day. So next night at dinner, she goes, have you thought? I said, yeah, I gave it a lot of thought. I want to be El Jefe. Isn't that a great name? Yeah. You're in a mall, 5-year-old going, El Jefe. You're like, that's me.
That's fantastic.
She says, no, you can't do that. So, Papa. But the first time they say your name, I missed that with my kids. I was always, no cell phones when my kids were young. Mm-hmm. So I'd get the call at night. Oh, he's talking now. He said your name last night, Dada. He said, Daddy, you know, and I'm like, I missed that. I missed the first steps. I got to see it with these grandkids. And it means so much. And then it brings in that regret that comes along with it. One of the scenes, we just wrote a pilot script for the book. We're going to, hopefully we're talking to Angel about it.
Oh, that's cool.
That would be nice. I don't want to pressure him into, you know, anything. But anyway, one of the scenes is I'm playing my father because obviously I'm too old to play me. where I pick me up at the drunk drive, got arrested for drunk driving. And I got to go from Chicago to Milwaukee to get him out of jail. We're driving back, having a conversation, and Cats in the Cradle come on. Both of us reach for the dial at the same time, you know. Yeah. And I remember driving on the road, listening to Cats in the Cradle and just sobbing. I had to pull the car over once because I knew I was missing everything with these boys, everything. But I had no other skill set. I mean, and I was raised in the generation. I don't know if it's the same now, but, you know, you're the breadwinner. You got to go out. You do whatever it takes, you know. And if it means being on the road 200 days a year, you go on the road. And I look at both my boys. They ran from this business. They wanted nothing to do with it, you know. And we moved 4 times, and we're watching some show on TV. And they talked about having to move 3 times. The kids were screaming at their parents. We're tired of moving. And my youngest son goes, that must be awful. And my oldest goes, where have you been living? This is our 4th house. You know? And I looked at Tammy. I go, well, they noticed. Yeah. But anyway, we've been in the same place now for 27 years.
That's great.
That's great. Yeah. Well, we're super excited to have you back recording another special.
Well, you might want to wait till you see the special.
Well, at least we got the chance to talk with you and learn from you today. Yeah. Is there anything you want to say to the audience before we sign out of here?
Thank you. I mean it. Thank you. Dry Bar changed my life. You know, I had a nice career, but I'm back in clubs. I thought I'd never do another club. I was out of clubs 20 years. And because of Dry Bar people, you know, they... I love the question. Where's he been? I started in 1978. You know? So, but yeah, thank you. And if you know, sharing whatever you share, I mean, however it works, I don't know, but thank you for that. I appreciate it. And the kind words that they write and everything means a lot. I may not comment much, but I read a lot of it, and it's nice.
That's cool.
And there's a couple of you negative ones out there. I just want you to.
I
read
you.
Those too.
On the internet?
And we hope you're not 6'7" and really tall.
Yeah.
Well, I did host your first special. I don't want to take all the credit for how well you've done, but I think I set the tone pretty well.
I think you did. I said that backstage. I go, if it wasn't for Jordan, man.
Just want to throw it in there. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. No, it's awesome. It's cool how much you've done on Drybar and the going back to clubs and stuff. It's just,
well, I think it's neat because I get a chance to see the young guys working. And it's, you know, again, I love the process. You know, I love working with people who love stand-up. And again, I worked with guys that their whole goal was fame. I mean, that was it. And they did what they needed to do to get there, and they got there. But I never looked at their stand-up and went, oh, you know. I mean, they did the bare minimum. They just had wonderful personalities, and for 6 minutes they were hot and good, you know. And that was the goal back then, was to just get on the box.
Right.
And the internet has changed everything now. And believe me, I've seen some of those. What do they do? I don't know. We don't care. The room is full.
Yep, you know? Exactly.
And for all I know, they smash things in their head, you know, on the internet.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for not being one of those.
Yes. I mean, the opposite of that.
I have no choice. It's the only skill
that's
I have.
You think you do.
My fear is at the end of my life, all I'm mumbling is my act. My grandchildren are going, what's Volkswagen? What's he? Did he ever own a Volkswagen? What's he talking about?
Well, thank you, Jeff, for coming on. And thank you to the viewers.
Yes.
We really appreciate you tuning in each week. And leave a review if you enjoyed this chat. And
yeah, check if you out. Liked it, leave a nice review. If you didn't like it, nobody likes a whiner.
Yeah,
nobody.
You know,
just remember that.
Why, if you did, why are you still watching?
Yeah, leave an ironic nice review if you didn't like
it. Yes, we won't know it's sarcastic either way. Well, this has been the Drybar Comedy Podcast, and we will see you next time. Bye, folks.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.